You okay, Rina? You seem stressed. What's going on?
Do you ever feel that parenting a disabled child is chaos, like absolute paperwork chaos? There's just so much admin on top of caring for your kids. It's like I'm my freaking daughter's PA.
Ah, yes. You should try the new Hibi app.
An app?
Not just any app, it's Disabled Parenting Mega PA organization. So you can schedule appointments, have reminders for your medication, have all of their medical notes and letters in just one place.
Hang on, spell this out to me again.
Hibi, Hibi. It's a disabled parenting organization app. I wish I'd had it when B was younger. It gives me a sense of control over, well, the uncontrollable.
Sounds intriguing. Who doesn't want to organize disabled parenting chaos one notification at a time?
Haha, yes, it's my new sidekick. Sidekicking the shit out of disabled parenting organization.
That's the least catchy strapline I've ever heard, Lauren.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. They won't want it. But if you, like Rena and I, want to give it a go, you can download Hibi for free on the App Store now. So today we spoke with Camilla Cook. Basically, her whole life was turned upside down during the pandemic when she was pregnant with her youngest, Silver. It's about uprooting and rerouting because she had to leave the country she was living in. Her life was changed by the conditions that they discovered to do with her unborn baby and when Silver was born. But also, her life was changed in respect of her work, where she was living. She left friendships behind. It was a huge, huge change in her life. As Camilla refers to in the episode, she really does acknowledge, she had so much support and so many advantages when it came to this situation, her privilege at being able to come back to the UK in the situation she was in, having family members here that were able to step in and support her. Getting her tapped into the NHS and systems of support may have taken time, but it was absolutely there for her. And yeah, I think it's just we are very aware of that, and she is very aware of that. And so it's just her story and her experience of uprooting and rerouting. Do you feel you've rerouted your life as a consequence of Lua? What's changed? What's the knock-on impact been?
I think when you have a special needs kid, it's going to change everything.
Yeah.
Not only like the way that you view your child and all of the hopes and dreams that you had for them, and also you as a mum, but I think for me, it's had knock-on effects on how my friendships have changed. Not to say that I don't love my friends and they're fab, because you are, and I know you listen. Love you.
Careful what you say.
But I don't see my friends. Especially my like childhood friends or girls that I went to school with and grew up with, you know who you are. I don't see you enough. And I think there's a group of four or five of us, and it's just that our life paths are changed. Some of us have children, some of us have special needs children, some of us are like traveling the world and doing other things, some of us are like super into our careers, so incredibly busy. And I think it's having that acceptance that it's not that I don't love my friends, but this is just what it is for me now. It may not always be like this. And I think in the beginning, I tried really hard to maintain those friendships, and it's hard because you're juggling so much other stuff. Something has had to give, and sadly, my friendships have had to give.
Yeah, it's hard when it's, I think it's true with anything that's going on in your life. It's like actually, you do want to connect with people who get it when you, at times, and when your time is extremely limited, like it's hard to do all the maintenance that's required to keep every friendship going at the same pace as it once did. I think that's kind of natural as you get older and your paths go in different directions. But it's,
100%.
yeah, particularly when you've got a kid that's
Exactly. And then
disabled.
you end up, just because of the situation that you're in, you are surrounded by other parents who are in the same kind of same or similar boat as you. So naturally, you're reaching out to those people because they get it. So
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think my life's changed in lots of ways. job, which we've talked about a lot in the past on the podcast, but and wanting to go into and do something in the SEN space. And I think that's true of a lot of parents, not all, and it's like you don't have to be, but it's definitely kind of changed what I want to do professionally and where I want to invest my time. It's hard to know, isn't it? Because you don't know what you would have done anyway. But
true.
It's changed a lot. It's probably changed how I parent my older daughter, just because I've got that big fat perspective on what really matters. So this is uprooting and rerooting. I hope listeners enjoy. Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you. You're a dreamer, I am too, it's fucking normal we would rule the world. This is the Fucking Normal Podcast, the cheers, tears and Friday night beers of parenting disabled children.
I'm Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're both mothers to daughters with special needs. Parenting a disabled child can often feel difficult to navigate. If this is you, you're not alone. We're here to share unique parenting stories and chat about the things that we've learnt and are still learning.
Prepare to sometimes laugh, sometimes cry, but hopefully leave with a shot of optimism in your arm. And don't forget, we are talking from a parent's perspective. We would never presume to talk on behalf of a disabled child or adult. So expect bad language and, quite frankly, some brutal honesty.
Because really, what the fuck is normal anyway? Wake me up, loud as clouds,
all my love for you.
Camilla, our guest today, currently lives in Brighton with partner Will, five-year-old son Freddie, and Silver, who's just turned two. As an English teacher, she was living in Tanzania with Freddie and Will when she became pregnant with her second child. Silver has now got a peg, she's nonverbal and is utterly gorgeous. Even on Zoom when we last chatted, she charmed the pants of Lauren and I. She doesn't yet have a diagnosis, but Camilla is waiting on the results of genetic testing. So hello, Camilla, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me, really. It's lovely to be here.
How are you feeling? Not too nervous.
A little bit nervous, but I was thinking back to the reason that I got in touch with you first, because I just loved listening to that very first episode. Just was like, yay, voices like mine. And I just I'm just really, it's really nice that you've made time for me, so thank you.
We're very grateful you've taken the time to be on the podcast. So can we start at the beginning? Where were you when you fell pregnant with Silver, and kind of what was happening with the pregnancy and all of that?
Yeah, so I was we were in Tanzania, and as you mentioned, and I was teaching there in an international school, and that's kind of what our life had all been for the last 5 years. Prior to that, we were in Thailand, and I had my son in Thailand, and it was all pretty straightforward, and you know, despite no opportunity for pain relief during birth, because most of them have C-sections, his birth was pretty straightforward. Wow. Everything was fine, and you know, it was this sort of glowing, lovely initial year and a bit with him, and then we moved to Tanzania, and I was just feeling super confident about being a mum that can handle like having a baby in a developing country, and so yeah, we were trying for quite a long time to get pregnant with Silver, and then we did. And it was just a funny time because it was COVID, and Tanzania had a policy at the time, and I need to pick my words quite carefully, because it was literally illegal to mention the word COVID or coronavirus. You couldn't talk about it, you couldn't put it in writing, you couldn't put it in an email. So the school that I was working at, we had to refer to it as a respiratory illness. Because of the respiratory illness, we closed the school following the lead of the rest of the world.
Wow.
And it was really scary, because the government then sued the school for doing that, because there was no COVID in their eyes.
Oh my God.
Magically, it stopped at the border, didn't cross over. And the president at the time was basically really worried about the economy, because if everything shut down, unlike here, it would mean people would starve to death. And I think, you know, with the, with this country's best interests at heart, he basically was like, right, we can't, this can't affect us. It has to be, we have to push on through it. But all sorts of interesting advice was flying around that, you know, you just go into these inhalation chambers and suck on a lemon and eat a bit of ginger and you'll be fine. Like, yeah, it just, it was a crazy time. So there's a lot of anxiety anyway.
Were you worried? Were you, because I'm sure that you were talking to your friends and family in the UK and abroad who were living a different COVID life.
Yeah.
Were you kind of stressing about the situation?
Yeah, hugely. It was really stressful, especially because we got COVID really early on. And there was a weird thing around it because our friends, we'd been away with them for the weekend and they then had it and knew they had it, but didn't tell us. And then we got it and found that there was a weird dynamic with them. And there was just a lot more kind of caginess around it because there were fears that we would be, if anybody with it would be taken to like a, what do they call it? Like a quarantine camp thing that they built for Ebola. So right out by the airport, there was this huge building, which was just concrete boxes. And people were talking about us being put in there if we had COVID. So there was loads.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then we're watching, obviously, the UK news to get our news. And I don't know if you remember the John Hopkins University map that everybody was obsessed with at the beginning, which like showed all the cases across the world. And I was one of the 500 and something people that Tanzania acknowledged as having COVID because I got tested. But from then on, the people went for tests, but the only result that was possible was that it was negative. So essentially you either didn't get a result or you got a negative result because there were no cases. It was just not allowed.
And were you pregnant by this stage or not?
I don't know. This was before, but the whole kind of atmosphere of the time, I mean, everybody experienced it in their own way, didn't they? But in Tanzania, it was a weird one. And we kind of got to know the medical services quite well. So when I did become pregnant, I was aware of the limitations, basically, of what there was there. There was all sorts of,
right,
you know, information going around about how they had one ventilator in the whole country. And having just strolled through Thailand and pregnancy and doing it there, suddenly it became a lot more kind of scary. And actually we went to our 20-week scan and just said, oh God, imagine if something was not right. And then something wasn't right. It was, you know, the whole Tanzania thing has just added a weird flavor to it. It was all very, very stressful. And I wish I could say, you know, I just took it in my stride, but no, they were definitely.
Did you know, kind of, because you'd already had your baby, had Freddie in Thailand, were you planning to have Silva in Tanzania? Or was it always, I'm going to fly back to the UK and have my baby there?
Yes, we were always going to fly back. That's what's recommended, which gives you an indication of the facilities that they have. And also another, I want to come back to it, but, you know, just made us so aware of how privileged we were that local people didn't get anywhere near the same care as us. And that was quite a weird dynamic as well, just being conscious, very conscious of our privilege. But anyway, yeah, we were always going to come home. We ended up having a 20-week scan. She had a club foot and she was very tiny. And then there was abnormality with the uterine artery, the flow, something. I forget all of the technical terms, which I think is a slight sort of defense mechanism because I just I can't hold it all in my head and that's okay. So we knew that we needed to come back, but we still thought that we'd return. So I left all of our, apart from a suitcase of stuff, we left all of our belongings, furniture, the cat, flew back, left my job, didn't say goodbye really, apart from just, you know, see you on the other side. And most people who are pregnant would return anyway and then come back to Tanzania. So we just assumed it would all be fine. And then it got to, Silver was born, and there were more and more complications in the UK. And we realised that we weren't going to be able to go back. And we made that decision, which was actually a huge relief when we did decide that we were going to stay here. So, yeah, it was a big shake up. I think it's Eddie Izzard who's got a quote from one of his stand-up gigs where he talks about the Etch-a-Sketch end of the world. Like, do you remember the Etch-a-Sketch where you turn it upside down and you shake it? And it just somehow felt a lot like that, and that it didn't necessarily have to be a bad thing, but just everything suddenly was cancelled. Like all of my career was suddenly, a stop was put to that. Will had just trained to be a teacher and he had to put a stop to that. Freddie was about to join the school, you know, we were getting him ready to go to his first year of school and he couldn't go. So it was like suddenly everything was thrown in the air. But then the way we managed to deal with that was just thinking about it as like a new opportunity to draw a different picture, a different picture. So, yeah.
So beautiful.
And how was it when Silver was born? So you knew some things, but what was going on and how did you cope with that at the time?
The time from when we flew back to the UK, when we flew back to the UK to when she was born, let's say 3 weeks after she was born, that was the most stressful point. And I actually think it is going to be the most stressful point of, you know, the rest of our lives, because it was really intense. From the 20-week scan, it was a bit tricky, but we were still kind of calm about it. And we couldn't find out any information about what was going on until we got back to the UK anyway. But when we flew back, from that period until she came out of the NICU, which was 3 weeks after she was born, was really, really stressful because, well, first of all, the quarantine hotel was a fun bit. We flew back to the UK and then had to stay in a quarantine hotel for 11 nights, which meant that we were basically stuck in a room apart from 15 minutes a day when we were allowed out. I was pretty pregnant, Freddie was three, and it was just this kind of almost like funny, like bad in a comedy way. Like it was just so extreme that we were able to laugh at it. And actually, do you know what, the conclusion that I've drawn from all of this is like the silver linings are there everywhere. We had, as a little family of three and a half, some of those times were actually really fun. And we had to really make an effort with Freddie, and our family were really good and sent us stuff that every day we had a little parcel to open, and it was a bit of Lego or it was Play-Doh or whatever. So we just had this time together that we wouldn't otherwise have had. I mean, some of it was really hard as well, but we had food delivered to us. You know, we decided we had to pretend we were on a slow boat from Tanzania and that it would take 11 days to get back anyway. And we'd have a little cabin anyway. And we just talked about what, you know, the journey would be like otherwise if we were on a boat. Anyway, so then I wasn't registered with the NHS. So that was a whole crazy headache where I couldn't get an appointment. I didn't know what to do. Luckily, my health insurance was still going from my work. So we had to go to a private health clinic, go into a darkened room and be told that, yeah, probably our baby's, you know, going to be pretty poorly and have to have an amniocentesis. It was all just completely insane and extremely stressful. We didn't have anywhere to live. Having said that, my sister was an absolute hero. She has a little Airbnb at the end of her garden, which is actually, it's a room with a little bathroom. And she basically let us have that for what ended up being 6 months.
Wow.
So yeah, it was during that time, it was pretty crazy. And then somebody recommended me a woman who's an amazing midwife. She's a private midwife. And again, we were able to get that on insurance. And she completely changed everything. And she worked with us from probably about 30 weeks until Silver was born and after that. And she was literally the lifeline. She was incredible. Her name is Angie, and she was literally an angel. She couldn't be more amazing for us. And I'm somebody who needs to fix problems. And so, you know, I was going out, I got like counseling straight away. I found Angie. I was like trying to read things and find out about things. And actually the only beneficial thing of all of that really was Angie. And she came and hung out with us a lot and got to know Freddie and got to know my family and were just so helpful.
When Silver was born, were there surprises then? You know, you obviously knew about some of the things that she had going on with the club feet and the being small, but what was apparent when she was born, was that a shock to you? Were there additional diagnoses that were given early on?
Yes, so they were worried about her size. So she was 2.2 kilograms when she was born. And then there were various things going on. And actually, oh, no, I'd forgotten one thing. We'd gone to London to have a detailed scan of her heart. And her heart is unusual in the sense that it has, she has a bilateral superior vena cava, basically two veins where there should be one. And then she has a hole in her heart as well. So we knew that there was going to be heart issues. There were other various things on the scan that they couldn't quite make out. They're worried about her hips. Yeah, so there were just loads of things. And then when she was born, she had low blood sugar and they were a bit worried about that. I mean, do you know what? As I sort of implied before, a lot of it I can't remember.
As a caping, I feel like I'm a bit like that. I can't remember the details from back then because I had to sort of blank it out. There was so much information and so much trauma that you're going through that you just kind of have to, it's some of it is gone and that's maybe okay.
I don't know if this was the same for you. Like the speculation that was going on then hasn't necessarily translated into anything that we need to worry about. So one thing that helped me massively, and I can't say this enough, was that we were given a really scary hypothesis about the genetic condition she might have by a geneticist in London who was great, one of the top geneticists, really nice woman. And I actually asked her to be specific about what her concerns were. Mistake number one. Mistake number two was Googling it on the way home. Oh my gosh.
Oh no.
And it was such a mistake because she didn't have this thing. And, you know, it was just an idea. And all of the tests came back negative for everything. So there was just no point in going through the real trauma. And some of the images that I saw and some of the things that I read are still in my head. And I since then genuinely haven't Googled anything to do with silver.
Really?
Not one thing.
Wow.
I feel like I'm listening to my story. Story is so similar to yours. Yeah, 20-week scan, heart condition. We thought she'd have a hole in the heart. She'd be going straight to the NICU for surgery.
Yeah.
None of that shit happened. Yeah. And then when she was born, there was like talks of different syndromes. And then there was one particular one that they were floating about that I heard randomly that I then did loads of research that traumatized me. And now I don't want to know anything about her actual syndrome. Like I just
don't
care. And it's such a flip from before where you're like, I want to know everything.
That's it. And if I think about my own state of mind, in that period I described when it was like quarantine hotel, when there was nothing else to think about, what were we doing? We're watching daytime TV and playing with Lego. Like there wasn't, of course, I was just worrying. To when, I don't know, because the doctors don't have any clue about what's going on, you know, there's no point in speculating. And that, I was so stressed during that time. And since I've stopped thinking, or as you're saying, Rena, like we stopped thinking about it and stop trying to project into the future and trying to imagine what everything's going to be like and just living today, then I just feel a lot happier. It's like I lived in a Buddhist country for 3 years and I never quite got the idea of meditation. Like it took having a disabled kid to realize that actually it's really valuable just trying to drown out the noise of everything else and just enjoy what's right here in front of you. So
that's beautiful.
So beautiful.
Not to add noise back into that picture, but I guess how was Will and your son? Because your son was, Freddie was three, right, when you came back. So I guess we're all very aware of the potential impact on a broader family of having a child who's sick or got a lot of medical things going on and there's a lot of unknowns. But your three-year-old had also gone through, well, having a sibling, that's a big deal. New person who's going to get as much attention as they are, potentially more in the early days, moving from his home or what he felt was his home, the global pandemic and all that came with that, and then Silver arrives and obviously your concerns are going to be off the charts and you're there in hospital running tests and stuff. How was that for your son and for your husband?
I feel really, really lucky. Just a quick word about Will, my husband. We've just proven to be such a good team. Like, so lucky. He just puts in hard work. I put in hard work and we've balanced it out. Like, we've got this dynamic where if one of us has a wobble, the other one is able to be really strong. let's hope that we never have a wobble at the same time, because that could be like some sort of catastrophe. We're quite good at sort of knowing what the other one needs. And he used to take Freddie away. So one massive part of the stressful period was the pumping. Did you guys do, were you pumping?
Yes. Pump.
Super fun with the really nice bras and the really nice machine noise, you know, that sort of noise that kind of seeps into your subconscious and is there forever.
You know, I still think sometimes I can hear it when I think about pumping. I swear to God, I can hear it in my head.
Definitely. It's deeply there. Oh, and God. Also everything that goes along with that, you know, Will was just really good at recognizing that he was never understand what it was to sit with a machine attached to your tits in the middle of the night, having woken yourself up. For a machine, like, it's one thing doing that for a baby who's thirsty, but for a machine, so you've got to keep going. And all the hormones are going crazy. And, like, you know, he knew he was never going to understand it. But what he did understand was that I needed support. And so he took Fred and they did loads of stuff. Like, we were staying at my sister's. And again, back to being lucky, we got Freddie into a little nursery. So he had something going on there. But Will used to take Freddie down the lane for walks. And they had this whole story about how these ducks had been magically turned into these alpacas, because one day they saw some ducks and then the next day they saw some alpacas, and Freddie was like, what's going on? And Will turned it into this magical thing, and a lot of kind of storytelling, a lot of playing, and then giving Freddie and me time as well. Will would, when Sybil was born, take her away, and just, we sort of divided things up and aimed to give him as much attention as we could. Whilst, like, recognizing, as you said, Lauren, he was never going to get as much attention as Silver at that time, and our thoughts were going to be with her, but trying to compensate, but also getting him used to the fact that that is just the reality. Like, we really were keen not to spoil him, and that was a bit difficult, especially because, you know, family wanted to do whatever they could, and he was being given presents left, right, and center, like, you know, as a sort of compensation. But we were trying to keep him involved in conversations and keep asking him how he was. And, you know, it was really hard for him to articulate it. And he struggled with sleep again, you know, regression and all of that stuff. But we got through, and family were amazing. Our family were absolutely incredible. Special shout out to my parents-in-law, who are heroes, really incredible. Really involved, really just chilled and reliable and dependable. And they stepped up. They came and stayed nearby the hospital when Silver was born. So they had Freddie, and Will and I could go in every day, and he didn't feel left behind. And yeah, I couldn't be more grateful for the support network that we had coming back. And it was, having not really had it in Tanzania in a hands-on way, that was this like lovely flash of beauty, like, that was part
like
of it,
like a warm, big warm hug, like,
exactly. And like, they were genuinely delighted to help, because they hadn't seen much of Freddie and they really wanted to be around, and same with my sister and her children and her husband. And yeah, there was just, we were really surrounded by love, and it was incredible. And that's why we're fine. Like, yeah. it's been that, and lovely things have come out of it that we didn't anticipate at all. Because of course I was there, like, really thinking, well, you go through, you don't need to tell you guys, but that morning of what you thought was going to be, and I had my little girl who I always wanted to have a daughter, and we had our perfect family all going to happen, and then it suddenly wasn't what we'd imagined. And going through that at the same time as being conscious of how much we were relying on everyone else was quite hard, because I think for me personally, I was not necessarily repressing it, I was conscious of not draining everybody else of what they, of their energy by talking a lot about it. And on reflection, I think there's maybe something maybe it's like deep trauma now that will come out at some point, but I did feel under a lot of pressure trying to balance managing it for us and our family, whilst also being conscious we were living in my sister's house. I mean, she was cooking us meals every day, and she really just took us in for 6 months. and her amazing husband, he's disabled. So that was just, you know, there's more and more layers to it. My sister just was just recovering from breast cancer herself. And just, you know, it was this kind of crazy.
Wow. So, and did you miss, because you say managing it and, you know, you referred earlier as well to, you know, we all know that feeling of this is not what I'd imagined potentially is. But you, I guess alongside that, your life had completely turned upside down in terms of your job and where you were living. Did you miss Tanzania, or was there any grief for that side of your life that had obviously taken a very different turn?
I mean, yeah, we used to go to the beach every day. And
sounds lovely.
And this again was this the other like narrative that was going on in my head was how privileged I was and how I shouldn't be. You know, I've got a baby girl. Lots of people can't even get pregnant. So I didn't let myself, I wasn't letting myself process it emotionally, I think, very much. Because yeah, we've gone from this absolute paradise situation where everything was easy. Like, you know, I had my job, my career was going where I wanted it to. I really enjoyed the school that I taught at. I really loved my colleagues. I miss my friends. I really miss my friends still. I haven't seen any of them since, apart from two of them came to Brighton, and that was amazing. But, you know, these are best friends, suddenly just poof, gone. Didn't even get to see them to say goodbye. My students, I didn't say bye to my students, and that was really sad. Yeah, and a lot of the lifestyle I missed. Little things that we joked about, you know, packing up and moving from one country to another is a massive headache. And we just basically didn't do that. So we sort of, our lovely friends packed some of this precious stuff, and the rest we just sold and made a bit of money out of it. You know, it didn't matter. It's amazing what it's taught us on about how kind of material objects just don't really matter.
Can we sort of fast forward a bit then? So you still haven't got a diagnosis for silver. What's that been like? Because you talk about not Googling or not kind of overly fixating on that aspect. Has it been not having a diagnosis? And is that something that you've been pushing hard for?
It's been a really interesting experience. Because I kind of implied earlier that I am someone who likes to fix problems, and not knowing what the problem was initially kind of challenging. But now I actually I'm not that bothered. Like, if anything, when we get a diagnosis, it will then mean that I have something to type into Google, and therefore I will, you know, the anxiety might rise a little bit. And it was a weird one, because we were getting all these negative results, and that's a weird thing, like actually hoping for a diagnosis of something that you can name, even if it's something bad, so that you then have this, you can make a plan. It's such a weird experience when actually you should be joyful that the results are coming back negative. I think that very quickly we were confronted with the fact that, you know, the medical knowledge is limited, and that having gone through life thinking that everything is fixable, if I got poorly there was a medicine to mend whatever it was, you know, that's now been thrown out of the window. And you know, we had another weird thing was that the geneticists in London took the sample from my amnio to run whole genome sequencing, because I think it only just been allowed on the NHS or something, and just was sent off. And then I don't know what's happened. She basically ghosted us completely. So since then I've not heard.
Oh God.
Now too. So that's over 2 years, not even a reply to an email. So we sort of gave up on that. And then our paediatrician in Brighton was like, yeah, maybe we should do our own one. So we have just redone that a couple of months ago. But I'm not really anxious for the result. I don't, in a way, I'm anxious to get the result, if that makes sense.
How it might make you feel exactly to have a result afterwards. It's really interesting because Bea was diagnosed with 18q deletion, her chromosomal abnormality, when she was 2 weeks old. So it was like really early on, when we weren't even expecting her to get diagnosed with anything. So we were just constantly told it's nothing, all of these things that we've noticed about her and this breathing episode and her stint in NICU. Yeah, it's not related to any. I mean, it was our expectations were managed in completely the opposite direction. So it was a real shock that there was this like label or diagnosis. But then recently I was just thinking, we had a bees and endocrinologist, and she was talking about some characteristics that she's noticed in bee that are similar to another patient of hers. And she suggested that we go and test for this other genetic mutation. Like, I just like, yeah, whatever, you know, kind of easy breezy conversation. I wasn't really focused on it. And then I got a call from the geneticist at Great Ormond Street to say, yeah, we're booking you in to run this other test. And I'm just like, what the fuck? It's similar to you. It's kind of like B is B. And I'm not sure this is going to tell me anything that I need to know about her. And it's that thing of, gosh, there's so many unknowns in the medical community. And I always feel like, and it's no, you know, I think she's great, this endocrinologist. It's no disrespect to her, but I do feel like this is like a medical curiosity to her. Like there's something academic that she's interested in. It's not really going to make any difference to B or to her family or.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe I'm being overly dismissive, but it's really, I think what you've described in terms of not being really anxious to get a diagnosis is probably a very healthy thing, because it's about Silver and who Silver is. And actually you don't need a set of criteria or a label to be comfortable with who your daughter is. Yeah. Does that sound?
Sounds exactly
right.
Exactly how I feel. And actually I feel quite proud about the fact that we both, Will and I, feel like that. Like I didn't expect it. I'm quite proud of it. I think it's evidence that we love her and we don't need to know what the future holds.
Yeah. But that's not to say that someone really desperate to get a diagnosis isn't, you know, doing that for the right reasons as well. Because I, you know, there are definite pros to that, you know, in terms of opening doors or, yeah, just getting understanding. But yeah,
if we get the diagnosis and then we find out that we can help her with it, then we absolutely will be delighted about that. I think it's just that, do you know what it is? It's that I don't want to have this inevitable relationship with the medical profession. I don't want it to be that I'm trying to get something out of them that they are not going to be able to give me, because that creates stress. Like there's no way, they have this incredible vast knowledge that is so far removed from what I know. They will tell me what they can, they will do what they can. I do believe that, as much as the NHS is stressed, I do really believe that they're wanting to, you know, help. So I kind of have just handed over responsibility for worrying about all of that stuff to the people who know, who are equipped to worry about it. And absolutely those parents, I was just going to ask you, Lauren, like if a minute ago you implied that you were not necessarily that happy about the test going ahead, would you ever ask for it not to happen? Like, I don't know, I'm in a bit of a conflict at the moment that whether I'm a bit too deferential to the doctors and whether I just let them do their thing, and whether that there's a balance to be struck between the way that I trust them but also the way that I should, as a parent, take some more responsibility.
Yeah, it's tricky.
And I worry a bit. I'm just slightly in denial and I'm just hiding from the reality. Like, I don't know, how do you feel about, if there was something you didn't want to happen, would you be able to say no?
Well, so Rina's my guru on this, because Rina is like so good at pushing back. And we've talked about it a lot, the things that she takes control. And I think I am definitely, you know, I take control in a lot of ways in life, but I am definitely also quite deferential to people who have a profession that I don't know anything about, or to the medical profession. But I think now I would say no. I don't know if I want to say no, because I'm, you know, that's a discussion between my husband and I. I probably need to do a bit of research on this specific gene mutation to know whether we want to get it be tested or not. But I would definitely feel more comfortable these days saying no. I think it's a tricky one because, yeah, it comes back to, I think, what difference is it going to make? And I think that you asking that question of yourself with your child as you go through all of these appointments and medical interventions is really important. B has a hearing loss and she wears hearing aids, and she's a really good wherever hearing aids, and that constantly the conversation comes back to, like, would she have some sort of an implant of some description, not a cochlear implant, and there are different surgery options she could have. And we keep kind of coming back to, well, what's the benefit? What actually, you know, she's a really good user of the aid now. Like, is this going to massively improve her ability to hear? And if not, then should we wait till she's older when she can have more autonomy, you know, more of a say in that? Or should we do it now? You know, I think it's good to question and not just take things on face value. And like I say, Rena is the best at pushing back and questioning. I need to get better at it.
I think for me, because with Lua was so fragile when she was born, that, and I was really young, so I full on trusted the doctors to do what needed to be done to get her to a place where I could bring her home. That was like the main goal. But then I think we'd been burnt by things. Not necessarily massively bad, but, you know, like, she had a tracheostomy, and we still to this day don't really understand why she needed to have a tracheostomy, which is such a life-changing surgery. And that's then caused her to have more issues. And yes, it's got her to the point where, like, she's happy, healthy, eating. It's like that balancing act. And I think once we got to that point where we were like, well, then why? What, when nobody could answer the simple question of why does she need it, it got me thinking, am I trusting these doctors to give her the best outcome, or are we just taking the quick and easy route? So now I question everything all the time. If it's not beneficial for her, it's a no. And that's across the board with, like, therapies, with professionals that don't really need to be involved in her life, to anything. I am much more, I lean more towards the no, and I need factual proof and real understanding before I agree to anything. Which I think I can be that annoying parent. I think sometimes when I walk into a consultation room, they're like, oh god, it's this one, she's gonna ask a million questions, and we've got to be on the game.
Yeah, but that,
it's just, yeah.
That doesn't matter. Lua's the one that matters. I mean, and that's the thing I've got to get better at. I definitely need to. One thing is that the physios have given us a chair, a special chair for her, which I don't really see why. I don't really understand why. And I remember when they wheeled it out, and they were really pleased that they had managed to secure the funding for it. And they showed it to me, and there was someone there who was literally a salesperson. Not trying to sell to us, but he was there showing all the features of this chair. And I was like, what? Do you know what? I suddenly felt incredibly sad, and I didn't really understand my emotion, and I started crying. And they didn't know how to handle it. And I didn't know how to handle it, because I didn't know why I was feeling like that at all. It was just this, it was just so medicalized. And it was, you know, there's not been any concern about her. She can sit up. She, you know, what is it this chair's for? Maybe we need a chair. And when she needs a chair, and when I understand that there's the need for the chair, then give me the chair. It's great, and how amazing. But I was sort of thinking, like, initially I asked them to explain. I just said, look, it just feels like a big change, and I don't really understand why she needs it. She's sitting up in the IKEA Antelope, you know, the one that everyone has. She was sitting in it, so why does she need the special one? And they told me, you know, you can sit her up and down, and the chair sits in the corner of the room. And I basically just bottled it, because I just thought, this is a really expensive chair, and we've been given it, and, like, we've got to feel grateful. And I reflect on that, and I feel a bit like, ugh, I should really have asked a bit more. So hopefully I can absorb some of your energy. You
know? It's not too late.
I know.
I've said no to that chair. I think it's the one that goes up and down, and it's got the tray, and it's got, like, yes, thing for the feet.
Yeah,
like, we had that same chair. I said no to it initially, and then I agreed to it because she needed it.
Yeah,
oh, it was similar. Her, yeah. Lua's one was, like, wooden, and then it had the thing that you pull and it goes down, and then, like, she outgrew it, and we just, like, never used it. So I had this whole back and forth with her physio. They were like, no, keep it, she needs to be using it, blah blah. I'm like, why?
Yeah.
why? And I got them to take it away. And she now has, like, one of those, like, Bumbo, like, plasticky ones that will sit on, like, on a normal chair. And I think there was, like, two things. I think when you see something that's so medical,
it's a big shock. And I think that's an issue that we probably have with ourselves. I certainly had it, where it's like, this is too medical for me. She's not that medical. She doesn't need it. Then it's the acceptance that actually, yes, she does. And then it's the seeing, because it's your child, you see them more and you see how much they develop, more so than a professional. So you know when they're ready to move on. And then it's that fight of, she's outgrown it. She doesn't need that. She's gone past that. She needs something else. So it's a mixture of a lot. And I think you have to really trust yourself, because ultimately that's that saying, you know your child best, like you know what's best for them. So
yeah, but then there is also the other flip. So I'm thinking for myself, you know, in reflecting on, is this just the easier route for us? Like, we've had this the conversation moving from the NG to the PEG, and there is no doubt that Silver was really struggling with the reinsertion, which we were having to do every few days. So that was an easy win for her. We wouldn't have to shove a tube down her nose often. And then we also think that, and know that, if she is able to feed overnight and we can sleep and she then has the day free, then that is the ultimate aim, and therefore it's worth working for. So we've come down on the side of it being a good idea. But then I was thinking, hang on, is this so that I can sleep? Am I really wanting this for her because she can then, it makes our life a bit easier? And again, this kind of like question of, right now she's had the PEG, she's vomiting more than she was before, so it hasn't helped. And I'm feeling like, oh my gosh, she's got a hole in her stomach, which we decided would go in. And, you know, it's this real conflict that you have, isn't it, in your own mind about what is that? You're so responsible for a child. You're so responsible for a child anyway. And
I think your own life being easier is also valid. I think that has to come into it as well, because if you get more sleep, you're going to be, like, without sounding really cheesy, you're going to be a better parent to Silver. And, you know, I think it's completely valid, you as parents having, you know, we could all kind of just be complete slaves to our children 24/7. We would completely burn ourselves out. That's not realistic, and it's not what's going to be in their best interests longer term, because they need parents who have slept. And
yeah, you're right. And I remember one of your first episodes, I think it was Genevieve, who said that self-care had become a much bigger priority for her. And that really resonated with me. And I've had that in my mind, because it doesn't come that naturally, but it's really important, because I know that I'm better at everything if I'm feeling good. I'm still like definitely making bad decisions when it comes to, you know, exercise or loads of beers. Like, which one?
So
we know which one would be the one that we would pick, but
I think I'd get both, do a run and then have a beer. Yeah. So how is life? How is Silver and family life now?
Life's really good. And it's, you know, some of it is really hard. And I'm conscious that we're in a nice little sweet spot, that she's progressing. She's still teeny weeny. She's way below the centiles, whatever they are. I'm trying not to
see. Percentile, schmentiles.
Exactly. And we don't have any answers. You know, she's been diagnosed as having a little bit of hearing loss, but she definitely can hear. She's nonverbal. She's not making any signs of becoming. I mean, she makes noises, which are hilarious and very sweet. So we enjoy those. There's a lot to enjoy about her. She actually isn't very hard work, because she's just started crawling, woo-hoo, which you're really happy about.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's really so good. Cool. And she has, yeah, she's happy when she's happy. She's still vomiting a lot. That's just, you know, part of life. But yeah, we're conscious of the fact, you know, other parents with kids similar age are doing things that we can still do with her. And we're sort of surprisingly happy. And I know that it may not last. So it's kind of a weird, like, knowing that things might get harder is something that I'm constantly trying to not think about. Because right now, you know, we live in a lovely flat. We're right in the middle of town. We go out to the beach. We just bought one of those wagon things that people have at festivals, and we just put the kids in and loads of stuff and go like Look at the sea and just and play. And Freddie is super happy at a school, a fantastic school. And the lovely thing about the school is that in his class, there's a boy who's also got non-diagnosed syndrome who they are absolutely brilliant with, from what I've seen, and that's minimal, but it's a really lovely, reassuring thing that I can see Silver's future and it's a supported one. Brighton generally has got loads of services. We definitely picked the right place to move to. You know, it's kind of nice. It's really nice, actually.
We like a happy ending.
That's gorgeous.
What do you think's been the most helpful thing to get you from, like, if you had to pick something from where you were in the initial stages of just rabbit and headlights, dealing with everything that was going on, to now, what would be? It's hard to pick one thing, I guess, but is there anything that stand out?
Just as cheesy as it is, just remembering how lucky we are and feeling grateful for that. That's been a huge one for me, that there are so many, you know, count your blessings, that phrase that didn't really mean anything, but just really does now. Like, there's so much to love about everything, and especially because everybody's struggling. Like, it's, I don't know, unfortunately everything's been turned upside down, and for many people because of cost of living and that, I don't know, the fact that we've got a little family unit and we're all pretty happy, it feels like quite a good thing and an easy thing to enjoy, if that makes sense. No googling, as I already mentioned.
It's a good one.
We talk about things a lot. We play. We do quite a lot of playing and having a silly time, seeing friends, definitely enjoying being back in the UK. And again, it's because we hadn't had that for the first 5 years of our marriage. We lived in Thailand. Now being back here, there's still a novelty about being here. You know, just even Amazon, the fact that I can get something from Amazon, I can go and get, we can go dancing to music that we actually like, or we can see live music, or our friends are just down the road. I don't know. There's so much that's quite novel still. And also camping holidays, that is the thing. So we have no money, extra money at all. So I did invest in a bell tent, which was secondhand. And now that's our, like, it's heaven. Actually, exploring the UK, we were jetting around all over the world before. And it, you know, especially because we shouldn't be doing that because of the climate crisis. Now it feels like it's serendipity. We now can't do it, but we're actually really enjoying being in a field or a forest and, I don't know, just doing English things. Quite nice.
Yeah. Do you think you'd ever travel again or want to go abroad again and work abroad?
That's a good question. I love teaching the IB, which is the International Baccalaureate, and not many schools teach it. You have it as part of their syllabus in the UK, and I really, really like it. Not that it's perfect, but it allows teachers to, especially English teachers, which is what I am, to teach in a way that suits them and suits their students. And that's what I want to be doing most in the world, and international schools are where it happens, where they choose that as their curriculum most. So I think if things settle down with Silver and we know we can manage it, then yeah, we would consider when Freddie's ready to go to secondary school. At that point, we might go to an international school, whether it's in Europe or further afield. It would have to depend on how Silver's doing, but that would be really nice, because Will's got this teaching certificate and he's an amazing teacher, and now he's back to copywriting because we can't afford to have him on a starter teacher's salary, you know. So that's one of his dreams that has been squashed a bit by the situation. So it'd be nice if we could go back to a good school where we were supported. I think we're sort of daydreaming about Scandinavia, where there's really good, like, social care. That would be fun.
I see an uprooting, rerouting part two.
Yeah.
we'll talk to you live from Scandinavia or something.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. You kind of answered it, but if you think of yourself in that quarantine hotel worrying about baby's future and everything that was going on and life is just in a complete spin, if you could give yourself some advice or tell yourself how it was going to be okay, what would you say?
I'd first of all reassure myself that all three of us would be, and Silver actually, all four of us would be strong enough to handle it. All of us have, like, shown really good resilience, I think, and in the face of challenges, we've all of us overcome them, and that in itself is a really valuable experience. Like, as a teacher, we talk a lot about grit and how you can develop grit and perseverance and determination in students, and it's not easy to do because you can't really manufacture challenges very easily as a teacher. Like, right now I'm just gonna not give you everything you need to be a happy student, to see how you get on. Like, that's not very ethical. So it's really hard to do that. And I think the benefits of overcoming challenges for all of us has been a real positive. And that, yeah, knowing that we weren't all going to fall to pieces would have been nice. Another thing is that Silver, just because she's disabled, doesn't mean she isn't happy. I don't know, I just sort of imagined it was all this terrible catastrophe and she would be a really miserable person. And no, she's got a really naughty sense of humour. She's sort of really, she finds things really enjoyable and really, she's really happy. And that just because she's different from Freddie, it doesn't mean that she's not as happy as him. Another thing is that I would love her as much as I love Freddie, because I don't know about you guys, but that was a tricky one. Like, I was suddenly thinking, uh-oh, am I going to just put all of my hopes in this one boy, and how on earth is he able to, will be able to withstand that? You know, that's far too much to put on a person. And it's also such a toxic way to think about your kid. And I don't know, it just, that was, I grappled with that for quite a long time, and I feel like we're past that now. And yeah, just, I don't know, that ultimately being disabled is not an irredeemable catastrophe, and that the world needs to change. This is such a cliche thing, but you know, the fact that they just have disability pride, we need to be working hard on changing cultural views, I think. And if I don't have time for it, but like, you know, I hope they sort of galvanize. Well, what you guys are doing is great, you know, just sort of trying to educate people and make people feel that it's not a disaster. It's just, it's hugely challenging. It's knackering. It's hard. It's really emotionally draining. It's also funny and heartwarming, and like, it invokes pride. And it's sort of, I don't know, there's the flip side, that there's the light side to the dark. Mm. And that's the same. It just looks different with other kids. And so this is what I'm doing so far. My armchair activism is very minimal. I'm sort of following a lot of people on social media and just feeling super inspired by the attempt to shift the narrative from, oh dear, poor you, why are you in the wheelchair, for example, to I'm in a wheelchair, deal with it, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I hope that Silver grows up in a world that shifts to that, and I have hope, but it does require a lot of work. I think that's ultimately how I feel about my conclusion. is that there is hope, but it's gonna be a bit of hard work. Thank you for your podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah, beautiful.
It sounds like you're in a really good place, and I tell you, when I'm next in Brighton, watch out, because I'm gonna be like messaging you that I'm coming down. I would really love to meet Silver in real life. She's gorgeous.
So to end the episode, as always, we're gonna ask our guest Camilla what her fucking normal is. So Camilla, what is your fucking normal?
My fucking normal is being really pleased when my daughter vomits in front of a medical professional. firstly, because they get to see that it isn't normal, it's not just reflux. Secondly, because I can immediately get the measure of them as a person. And I don't know about you, but I have very strong feelings toward medical professionals. I basically either loathe them or deeply fall in love with them.
Yeah, me too.
And the way they handle her being sick is a good measure. Obviously, I wish that she isn't puking everywhere. But also in a doctor's office, I don't have to clean it up. So it's
win, 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 win.
Yeah, triple win. I get it. I love the fact it's a barometer as well.
Amazing. Oh, well, thank you so much, Camilla Cook, for being on our podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. It's lovely to meet you both. And
thank you so much for listening to the Fucking Normal podcast. We love making this podcast.
Yes, we do.
We're part of a much bigger team, almost exclusively all parents of disabled children. And our goal is to reach as many people as possible and create a community of support for parents and carers who share our experiences.
So, if you've liked what you've heard, please like and subscribe so that we can reach out to more people. You can find more information on this and other episodes at fkingnormalpodcast.com. That's fkingnormalpodcast.com. You can join us on Facebook and on Instagram at fkingnormal_podcast. That's fkingnormal_podcast. You can get all the links and more information in the show notes below.
So thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Wake me up, loud as clouds.